The recordings have started, sir.
Thank you. Okay, Glenn, if you would you please do the roll call?
Pleasure. We have Paul Deer, who is leading the group. Mike O'Connor from the business constituency. Barbara Steele from the registry constituency. Adam Eisner from the registrar constituency. Michael Collins, business constituency. Mark Trachtenberg from the IPC. And we have apologies from two people. Just let me pull up their names for you. Sorry. We have Kevin Ertman and James Bladell. I'm sorry I was so long.
Not a problem, Glenn.
And then from staff we have Marika, and Olaf is with us today, and myself.
Okay.
Can we also reflect that Scott Hollenbeck is here as well?
Thank you. Scott's joining as our guest speaker, helping with the registry perspectives.
Guest answerer.
Answerer. And I'm sorry, Glenn, as you ran through it, did you note Michael Connor is with
us
today?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Excellent.
Yes.
Thank you. All right, everyone. Thank you very much for joining again. Sorry, we're getting started a little slow. I was late myself today. We're going to dive right into it. As Barbara has just mentioned for us, Scott Hollenbeck from VeriSign is with us today, hopefully to share some of his technical expertise, help us with our discussions of potentially using EPP mechanisms to facilitate the sharing of the registrar email. Basically, issues that we've raised or started to discuss surrounding our first charter question. And just for the record, and I always encourage everybody to kind of check throughout the week, as of yesterday evening, I did not see any additional public postings to the open list for the general public. We'll continue to monitor that. And just as a reminder, our constituency statements are due no later than the 3rd of October. If at all possible, getting them in sooner is always appreciated. But just to remember, that deadline is coming up pretty fast. And look forward to everybody's input there. If it's good with the group, since we have Scott on the call, makes most sense to me probably to, use his presence and focus on this first question. Scott, I'm not sure if you've actually seen the language, if you have it in front of you, but just for the record, what we've been charged with here is addressing the question of whether there could be a way for registrars to make registrant email address data available to one another. The question notes that currently there's no way of automating approval from the registrant, as the registrant email address is not a required field in the registrar who is. This slows down and or complicates the process for registrants, especially since the registrant can overrule the admin contact. In our previous discussions in the working group, we've noted, of course, that this applies only to the thin registry models, i.e. .com and .net. And Barbara offered and you graciously accepted, so we have you here today to kind of focus on the idea, are there any mechanisms, any opportunities perhaps? We talked about the poll function in EPP, or perhaps anything else that we haven't considered yet that might help us, an opportunity to address this question of sharing the registrant email address to help simplify, automate, speed up, etc., transfer requests.
And this is also keeping in mind that obviously the registrant email address is only available in thick registries. Thick registries. So the mechanism would have to be something that would allow registrars, if you will, to be able to talk directly between one another. And I'm not sure if that's possible. So you get any light there?
Yeah.
As you all just noticed, by definition, a thin registry does not maintain registrant contact information, so the information does not exist in the registry database. Short of, you know, changing either EPP and or the definition of, you know, what a thin registry is, there is nothing that can be done that way. The registrars maintain that information, and so as Barb said, it might be easier to focus on mechanisms for inter-registrar information sharing.
The question is, Mike Rodemaugh, the question is whether EPP might be modified to facilitate that.
Well, and as I said, it could be, if the definition of a thin and a thick registry is also changed.
Why would that have to change? Why would Verifine have to do anything differently if they had the EP protocol such that registrars could share that piece of information directly?
Because right now we do not maintain any registrant information in a thin registry. What you're talking about would be either adopting some or all of the what was currently called contact information that exists only in thick registries.
I understand what you're saying. Great. I'm not sure you understand what I'm saying, but get to the bottom of it. I'm not asking for VeriSign. We're not talking about VeriSign getting any additional information. We're just talking about using the tool in order to allow registrars to exchange a piece of information directly.
What tool?
EPP.
EPP is a registrar registry protocol. It's not registrar to registrar.
Okay, that helps. I understand that.
All right. Yeah, so if you're saying not giving any additional information to VeriSign, the registry, you've just eliminated EPP from the discussion.
Now, this is Michael Collins. I know that you work for VeriSign, and VeriSign, at least most of the .com and .registry, I mean .net registries are thin, but can you speak to us about whether EPP would be helpful in a thick registry and how it might be used?
In a thick registry, the registry does indeed maintain this information. So there would be no protocol change required. What you might have to implement is a policy change such that, you know, both registrars that are involved in some kind of a transfer transaction can get access to the contact information, you know, instead of having to go through who is. Once both registrars can, you know, see the registrant's contact information, you know, the email addresses are there, they're available, and they can be retrieved at will.
What type of a command would be used to do that? Is there
the info command?
Info. Okay.
Mm-hmm. This is Mike O'Connor. I have a question.
Please, Mikey.
One of the my apologies for the background noise. I'm driving, so if it's annoying, let me know and I'll drop off on mute again. But one of the ideas that emerged was the notion of perhaps having two different sort of policy approaches, one for thick registries and one for thin. How practical do you think that is?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah. And I guess, not to put you on the spot, the notion being that because the thin registry doesn't have any contact information in it, you're right, EPP doesn't help much, but for the thick registries, it seems like EPP would work with this. And if so, what we could do is say, all right, we'll sort of have a two-thread policy discussion. We'll have one policy discussion for thick registries, and 1%. And I guess I'm just curious if that strikes you as something that's feasible from your perspective.
Well, if by my perspective you mean a technology perspective, I'd say, yeah, sure. As soon as you kick it up into the policy realm, I love it.
You know,
nothing for me to do, right?
But
let me ask maybe, you know, Barbara or you know, someone else on the call, are there any other precedents where ICANN has treated a policy in two different ways depending on if a thick or a thin registry was involved? I mean, if the answer to that is yes.
I personally have not seen anything. I would almost think that this question would be better posed to the registrars who would have to deal with basically two
different policies.
Two ways to operate depending on who they're sending a command to or who they're dealing with.
This is Mark Trachtenberg. It seems to me that while that's possible, it just seems not to be really efficient.
Yeah, I don't.
When you can have one procedure that fits both thin and thick registries, as opposed to two procedures, one for each, it just seems that one policy and procedure is so much more efficient.
Yeah, and this is Paul. I mean, if we all just look at everything ICANN has tried to do in the last couple of years, it's always to move towards consistency in its contracts and its relationships, et cetera. A level playing field, not two sets of rules or many sets of rules for different players. I think it would be difficult for this working group to make a recommendation proposal that would clearly distinguish two classes of actors.
And looking at how difficult it is to get one policy approved, to have a bifurcated system which essentially is comprised of two policies would just make it that much more difficult to actually accomplish anything.
Scott, this is Marika. If I can maybe ask a question as well, because I recall in the beginning of our discussions, I was also... the question of whether EPP could maybe be used for registrar-to-registrar communication, whereby then it wouldn't matter whether it's a thin or thick registry, but whereby registrars could exchange information concerning email information of the registrant with each other. Is that something that would be feasible in your opinion or your knowledge from EPP?
There's probably some subset of EPP that could be usable or useful, you know, to registrars in a registrar-to-registrar interaction. It would mean work for the registrars, right? They would need to operate and implement EPP server functionality, which they don't do right now. But they've already got the data, ostensibly, in some database of their own. So, possible? Theoretically, yes.
So, this is Mike O'Connor again. What about a third party, not a registrar, not a registry necessarily, but some third party performing the same sort of function that the registry would perform in a thick registry, basically maintaining this sort of information, this shared information, as the center to which registrars and registries subscribe. Would that work? So essentially, the EPP server would be neither at a registry or a registrar, but some third party that everybody could subscribe to and collect this kind of information.
But who? This is Mark Trachtenberg. I think the problem there is, you know, who would maintain that system? I mean, this is incredibly valuable and incredibly sensitive information. I mean, it goes to the root of you know, all the issues we see with you know, who is policy debate.
Right.
You know, what entity can be trusted, really, to manage that valuable and sensitive information?
Yeah. I would offer, just to echo what Mark's saying, you know, now we're going to be talking about having to create a new contracted party. Because the information that's going to be shared is not readily available. You know, therefore, it's sensitive information, and they're certainly going, you know, the registrars, the registries, whoever's involved in the process is going to be able to want to have, you know, guarantees for the protection of that information. You know, and immediately jump to mind, well, you do have a contracted party already sort of in the mix looking at Iron Mountain. You know, we all are doing the data escrow with them, but having been involved in the in working with them, they are not a real-time organization by any stretch. And you know, I think the whole purpose of this question is there a way to make this data available? We're looking to simplify, to speed up the process, recognizing again our constant trade-offs between security and simplicity or convenience. You can just focus on the convenience side. I don't think somebody like Iron Mountain is in a position. I think anybody would be hard pressed, a third party, to be in a position to provide the sort of data exchange that folks are looking for in this question in you know, business time, near real time.
This is Michael Connor again. I guess what I'd like to do is separate the questions into the technical and the policy. Since we have a technical person on the phone, I guess the question I'd like to pose is, technically, would that be useful? Because then, from a policy perspective, which I think, and a business perspective, which are the issues that I think you're raising, Paul, we have a different discussion. For example, in another industry, one of the ways that credit card information is handled is by a third party that's owned by all of the credit card issuers, that's Visa. And it would seem to me that something like that could be explored, but only if it's technically feasible. If it's not even technically feasible, then it's not worth having the policy discussion. So,
yeah, and truthfully, while, you know, it's software, anything can be done. I don't see it being technically feasible either. It would mean having to maintain a lot of this data in two places in real time. As a registry employee, I can't see any benefit, you know, to a thin registry operator, you know, basically saying, I'm going to hand you everything I've got just so that you can, you know, essentially set yourself up as, you know, having all of the same data that I've got.
Or even the registrar.
Truthfully, there is already a solution for this out there in protocol spec land. It's called IRIS. IRIS.
Huh? What's that?
It's been called Universal Who Is in the past. It was designed to be, you know, a Who Is replacement service. It provides different levels of access depending on who is asking the question. So, for example, you know, if registrars were to, you know, stand up IRIS servers, it could have one view for the general public, and it could have another view for other, you know, privileged entities like registrars or intellectual property attorneys, trademark attorneys, law enforcement people, you know, so on and so forth.
Who administers IRIS, or who would?
Well, what do you mean, the protocol or the service?
I mean, who administers the service and decides who gets what level of access?
Whoever's operating the server. So a registry would operate an IRIS server. They decide, you know, I guess subject to ICANN policy, who gets access to, you know, a registry-operated IRIS server. Similarly, registrars would operate their own IRIS servers, and they would have to implement them and deploy them, you know, according to whatever policy decisions are made.
And this is actually something that we've discussed in the registry's constituency as well, because there are, you know, various privacy laws in different countries. So one of the things that has been indicated by a couple of the registries is that they do use a tiered approach to who is access, or who is information, I should say.
This the IRIS server issue was brought up by ESSAC as well in one of the advisories that they did about who is. Go back and look at what they said about it.
So for tiered access, I mean, what are the two tiers? One that gives the registrant's email address and the other that doesn't?
It could be looked at that way.
I mean because they're required to give all the other information by the registry contract.
It could be. I mean, it could be that, you know, registrars get one view, the general public gets another, you know, government, law enforcement people get a third.
So it's basically unlimited depending on how a registrar wants to implement it.
That's correct.
But, I mean, aren't the registrars required to give most of the information already? So, I mean, it seems like the only piece of information that registrars are not required to show through, you know, who is on their website or through port 43 is registrant's email address.
No, I personally don't know that there's anything that stipulates what they actually have to show. I do know that there is information that they need to collect.
No, I mean, it's in the registrar accreditation agreement of the information they have to display through WHOIS.
Okay.
So, the only thing they're not required to do is register an email address.
So maybe they would just have two tiers, one that would provide that extra information for the registrant email address, and then the more public view, which does not.
This is Michael Conner. So what's the status of IRIS?
From what perspective?
I'm sorry.
As a protocol, it is out there. It is fully approved by the IETF. From a policy or implementation perspective, it's gone nowhere from a policy perspective. I do believe that there are some folks operating IRIS servers either as parts of test beds or as limited production services. And part of the problem is until there is policy that says someone needs to use it, there is a cost associated with building and deploying it, and no one wants to spend the money until it's going to be needed and used.
There's also additional administration costs as well. For example, how do you authenticate who's a registrar?
Yeah, Mark just
right.
Nailed it. I mean, that's a huge one, and it gets us back ultimately to the WHOIS debate. Because how do you identify? Sure, somebody can identify themselves as an FBI agent, and there are probably ways to vet that. Somebody identifies themselves as, an inspector in the local police force and pick any country outside of North America. How are you going to vet that? How are you going to vet them? This becomes a who is part two. It's the same issues surrounding IRIS from a policy perspective are some of the core complaints or concerns surrounding the who is issue.
This is Michael.
I would suggest that there are probably even larger issues because IRIS is much more capable.
This is Michael Collins. Though while it's more capable, we're not a who is work group. We're a transfer work group. Could we consider IRIS as a solution just for transfers, and only and use the auth code the transfer auth code that's already available to the registrant, and through the registrant to the gaining registrar as an authorization means, and not worry about FBI and all the other possible IRIS uses.
Yes.
Not sure I understood exactly what the question was.
The question is, we're not a who is work group, so we're not really concerned about who has access to it except a gaining registrar. And if we use the auth code, the transfer auth code that's used today, as a means to gain access to the IRIS information, and only that, no other access, couldn't that solve our problem with who has access to the information?
So how is the auth code used in this scenario?
The gaining registrar would have to provide it in order to get the registrant email address.
Okay, Mike, but Michael, help me think this one through. So in the system we have, an admin contact from forward says, I want to make a transfer. They get the auth code. So the auth code is then provided. And in order to unlock or reveal the registrant email so that there's, I'm a little confused because I just...
So basically you're saying that the registrant goes to the gaining registrar, they initiate their transfer, they submit the auth code to execute the transfer, then the gaining registrar sends the auth code to the losing registrar, which unlocks the IRIS server so that the losing registrar provides the registrant email to the gaining registrar?
That is my question.
That's what you're proposing?
It was more of a question than a proposal, but yes.
I believe that all of the registrars would have to implement IRIS for that solution to work. And again, it goes back to, I believe, the cost and whether or not they want to cross that bridge to do that, make that investment.
And Michael, just so I'm clear, I thought one of your concerns is that the existing transfer policy allows both an admin and a registrant to initiate a transfer request. Ultimately, the registrant is the final be-all, end-all in authorizing or approving. Or in some cases, coming back after a transfer and saying, wait a minute, I never let that go. In this example you just threw out, if it's the registrant that's initiating the transfer request, well, you're done already, right? They're going to know what the registrant email is if they're the registrant. I thought the concern here, you know, that we've been focusing on the last couple times we've raised this issue is if when it's the admin contact that is starting and we're trying to figure out is there a way to vet that request to make sure that we won't have a scenario where after the fact a registrant shows up and says, wait a minute, I never approved that.
Well, as Michael O'Connor said, we really apologize for the background noise, but as Michael O'Connor said, we were kind of separating the technical from the policy, but they're dependent upon one another. We cannot have the gaining registrar confirm with the registrant that he approved the registrant the transfer unless the gaining registrar can acquire the registrant email address. So it would require a policy change whereby, to add the security that I would like to see, would require a policy change that only the registrant can approve a transfer. However, if the gaining registrar cannot acquire contact with the registrant, that policy wouldn't work.
Piled up a whole bunch of people, including a cop.
I'm sorry, somebody want to get in the queue? Is that you, Mikey?
Oh, sorry, I thought I was muted.
All right. A lot to think about on this one, and Scott, we very much appreciate your taking time out to be on the call because I think you've helped us understand that, you know, that on the technical side there are possibilities here, but there will be some very fundamental policy questions
that
need to be addressed. And I don't want to necessarily use the metaphor cart and a horse, but both are obviously very important, but you've at least helped us clarify on the technical side, if I understood correctly, that there could be opportunities, but again, it would require basically complete adoption of those technologies, thinking of Iris here, and probably the only way you get that full market adoption is if it becomes a requirement, a mandate. Okay. Does everybody else understand it the same way?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Are there other questions while we still have Scott with us? Don't want to unnecessarily keep him on the whole call. Perhaps, Scott, if folks, especially some who could not join today when they're listening to the MP3 recording, and if they do have questions, can post them to the list, and perhaps Barbara, if you would, relay them to Scott, anybody for that matter, you know, from the technical expertise again.
Could I ask one last question maybe, Scott?
Of course, ma'am.
Sure.
Different question. From your view, what would be a higher investment, going for like extending EPP or the IRIS option? I know it's very difficult, of course, to estimate, but just from your knowledge.
Well, given the number of people that would have to implement IRIS fully for this to work, I would have to imagine that would cost more. EPP, well, then I take that back. The registrars would have to implement any EPP changes as well, and the registries would have to implement it. So it's probably a wash.
Okay. Thanks.
While I'm here, Barbara had also asked some questions, you know, offline about EPP authentication and, you know, the kinds of services that it already provides. Does anyone have any questions about that?
Anyone, Mikey, the subgroup that you guys were working on?
Yeah, well, Olaf here. Of course I've got a question. How does it work?
I'm back. Sorry. Getting in and out of mute on this is quite tedious. I do have some questions about authentication. I'm not sure that we need to soak up Scott's time now, but is the authentication in EPP and the authentication in IRIS roughly comparable, or are there interesting differences that would make it easier or harder to do things?
They're roughly comparable.
Okay.
I mean, they both ultimately use some of the same technologies to provide the same security services.
Is there one that, just from your experience, purely a personal opinion from you, that you would prefer?
IRIS was designed, you know, to provide this kind of query service. So in a perfect world, if there were no policy considerations, my preference would be for an IRIS implementation. That's not reality, though, so please, you know, take that for what it's worth.
Right. Let me then extend it beyond the just the authentication to the sort of the breadth and scope of the whole system, comparing IRIS and EPP. Do they do roughly the same thing, or is one designed to do one thing and one designed to do another?
It's the latter. EPP is a provisioning system. IRIS is a lookup system.
Okay.
Now, ultimately, you know, the data, you know, tends to flow through EPP into some repository and then potentially into another one where it's made available for public query using IRIS.
So, one wouldn't be able to eliminate EPP by adopting IRIS. One
That's
would
correct.
Have to have both running basis.
Completely correct. That's right. They complement.
Okay.
And I guess to address Olaf's question, can you just give a quick overview similar to what you provided to me on EPP and security?
Yeah, sure. EPP provides a couple of identification and authentication services. You know, starting right when the registrar tries to connect to an EPP server. It uses TLS, you know, which is sometimes mistakenly called SSL, you know, to provide confidentiality and authentication. You know, the connection is encrypted, and both the server operator and the client, or in this case the registry and the registrar, have to have digital certificates that are signed by some recognized certification authority. When the registrar tries to establish a connection, the registry looks at the certificate, says, you know, is this coming from someone that I know, and is it coming from a signed from a certification authority that I trust? And if, you know, those answers are all yes, it will allow, you know, creation of the SSL or TLS connection. There's also IP address filtering in place at most registries, you know, so that we ask the registrars, tell us which machines you'll be connecting from, and we're going to disallow connections from any other machines. All right, so once the registrar, you know, can establish a physical connection to the registry, the registry will, you know, respond to the connection attempt by kicking back a greeting, a little banner of text that says, I am the EPP server at VeriSign, for example. The registrar can look at that and then, you know, interpret the text and say, yep, I thought I was talking to VeriSign. This thing tells me it's VeriSign. I feel comfortable about that. The registrar is then required to provide a registry-assigned user ID and password, you know, to log into the server before it can do anything interesting. You know, it can't register domains, it can't initiate transfers, it can't look up information until it's authenticated and identified. Right? But once the registrar logs in, they can start to do some interesting things. Transfers cannot be attempted unless the gaining registrar, the registrar that's trying to initiate the transfer, can provide a password. And it's currently a password, though it's extensible. The other security mechanisms are allowed. But they have to be able to provide a password or auth info that's associated with the domain. And that association is made when the domain is registered initially, and it can be changed at any point during the valid registration period by, you know, the old registrar or the losing or current registrar, however you want to cast that. So the theory there is that either registrar allows registrant to create the auth info, or they create it for the registrant and share it with the registrant. At some point when the registrant decides, I want to transfer, they either have the auth info already because they created it, or they go to the old registrar and say, please tell me, give me the auth info. They then take that information with them to the new registrar and say, please initiate a transfer on my behalf. Here is who I am. The registrar authenticates them in whatever way they've currently implemented. And the registrant says, in addition to everything you already know about me, here is the auth info for the domain. The new registrar sends in an EPP transfer command, provides the auth info. The registry, executes the command, tells the old registrar, transfer requested. You have a certain number of times to respond to it. The old registrar then typically, picks up the notification that the transfer has been requested. Many of them will then go off and try to contact the admin contact and say, hey, we got a transfer request. Please confirm or deny it. And then based on, the response or lack of response, they do something. Many will let the transfer go through. If they get no response, others will say, nope, we didn't get a response, so we're not going to authorize it.
But that actually would be in violation of the transfer policy.
Yeah, there's policy, to deal with some of those things. It's not
right.
Protocol at that point.
Right.
All right? And so after a certain amount of time, something happens. Okay, either the transfer goes through automatically, the protocol says the transfer can also be rejected, all a matter of policy. And as I said, right now EPP provides a password-based mechanism for authentication information, but the actual protocol code there is extensible, and new mechanisms can be added, such as tokens that provide, one-time passwords or something. It's just there's been no demand for that kind of service, and so nothing's been done to extend it yet.
Corollary question, or two, actually. Shouldn't take up too long, much time, but the auth info code, well, the registrar knows it, registrar record and the registrant knows it. Is it also recorded in the registry?
Yes.
Yeah. And secondly, has there been any mishaps with EPP? Or is it sort of a very, very, it sounds like a very, very stable and reliable system, is it?
There have been none reported that I have ever heard of. No one has successfully cracked it, or otherwise, managed to get past, the hurdles that have been thrown up. Now, just the fact that I haven't heard about it doesn't mean it hasn't happened, of course, right? But the truth is, all of the security technologies that are employed with EPP were not developed solely for EPP. They're all basically off-the-shelf, proven technologies used in other places.
Thomas, A, that was a fabulous summary of the process. Maybe Marika could go through and sort of diagram that out. Question, is there a pictorial view of what you just described, essentially a flowchart that sort of lays out that whole process, that something that we could lay our hands on as a working group?
I don't think so. I know there's text, right? And if you wanted to go browsing through lots of boring IETF RFC documents, that describe EPP, you can find it there. But no, I don't think anyone has ever actually created, this is what a transfer looks like from end to end.
I don't know if others would find it as useful as I would. I'm a pretty pictorial guy, but I think it would be completely fantastic to have that picture drawn.
I'm happy to have a go at that if Scott, you wouldn't mind having a look to make sure that I've covered all the steps that you described here today.
Not a problem. I'd be glad to help.
And Scott, a follow-on question. The technology, EPP is a fundamentally a pull system. In other words, when the gaining registrar has initiated the transfer request, it's up to the losing registrar to query, to pull the notification from the registry that there's a transfer request pending. Is that correct? Or
no.
It's pushed out to them, letting them know.
It's both. There is a push mechanism to say, hey, losing registrar, there is some information here that you now need to retrieve. And, you know, they get that notice via the protocol, and they can then come in and pull the actual transfer request to get the details.
Great. And that would need to be clarified in any flowchart or whatnot, Mikey, because... The notification, will it be specific enough to say if there's information awaiting your attention specific to a transfer, or is it just there's information come into the system and come find out what it is?
It's specific to a transfer.
Right.
Is that designated by a code or something?
Yes. Right. There is actually a transfer query command that's available to registrars so that they can look at the status of a requested, of a pending transfer at any time. So yeah, I mean, the way this would typically work, the registrar gets notice that, you know, hey, transfer, here's the details. They can then go do a transfer query to get all the specifics, initiated at, expires at, you know, requested by, domain in question, all that fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is Mikey again. It's my job to ask the incredibly stupid question. And so here's my one for the day. Thomas, you mentioned that VeriSign runs an EPP server now, correct? Does that mean that in addition to the thin registries that VeriSign supports, you also support thick ones?
I'll have to ask Barb.
I think there may be some confusion over, you know, still what EPP does. EPP is a protocol that actually operates on servers, right?
Yeah. Between servers and clients.
Yeah, I mean, I can say that, you know, VeriSign, in addition to operating a thin registry, and whether you're a thick or a thin registry really doesn't have any impact on being an EPP registry, if you will.
Ah.
Yeah, again, I think we touched on that in the past, Mikey, that EPP as the provisioning protocol, extensible provisioning protocol, has been adopted overwhelmingly by registry operators throughout the world. So in the GTLD space and the CCTLD space, most folks are using it now. I think it's got touched on because it works very well. It does what it's supposed to do very, very well.
Yeah. So here's dumb question number two, which is, could the SIN registry be enhanced in a tiny little way to carry one piece of data, i.e. the registrant email address?
I think clearly it could be, but I mean that changes the whole nature of the concept of SIN registry.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
What we talked about earlier. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Was there anything else for me?
Just thanks, Scott. Very, very useful clarifications, and we'd only ask that if other questions come up of a technical nature, if we could reach out to you through Barbara.
Yes, please. Definitely through Barbara. She can help coordinate it and keep it all in sync.
Understood. But truly much appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you.
All right.
See you later.
Bye.
And, Mikey, just to follow up on the questions about flowcharts and whatnot, I did go back to our customer service people that handle transfer requests, looking for any graphics, flowcharts, documentation on what we do sort of behind the scenes ourselves.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't have anything like that. Definitely not anything graphic. And sort of the training manual that's used and whatnot, we're sorry, that's company information, confidential. We wouldn't be prepared to publish that. whatsoever.
Is there any way to scrub out the confidential part?
Ultimately, I'm not sure what it gains us, because based on what we have published for the customer-facing side and what we just heard from Scott in terms of how the provisioning system works, basically that's all we're doing. I think that's all any registrar is doing. The challenge is always comes up in these cases where there's a conflict between action taken by an admin and the registrant. The registrant contacts us, and then we pursue what is in each case almost a unique process of trying to reconcile what went on and making the registrant, who is the ultimate authority for a name, happy again.
You know, I'm pretty enchanted with the idea that maybe Thomas's summary could be transmogrified into that sort of universal back office flow. That may be enough.
Just for the record, Mikey, it's Scott Hollenbeck. I want to make sure we get it right for our report.
Yeah.
Thomas. Yeah, and you know, Marika, if you've offered to take it on, I mean, it probably, if you're going to try and turn this into a graphic, it would serve you well to just listen again to what Scott provided us, because I know from experience, reading through RFC documents is quite tedious, but you know he really just boiled it down to its essence for you. So,
yeah, I've taken good notes as well, so I'll listen to it again and look at my notes, and it should come up hopefully with something that makes sense.
Yeah, and honestly, it is very intuitive, and that's why it's such a widely adopted protocol. It was put together very intelligently, and it works well.
Olaf here, just a little stupid Swedish thought, and that is that maybe, well, we're talking here about a registrant email address, but on the other hand, if we were sure that only the registrant, apart from the registrar of record and the registry, had the auth info code, then that would be a solution as well, wouldn't it?
Sure, I believe that gets to Michael Collins' point that, you know, consideration of a recommendation policy change that says only the registrant is authorized to do the transfer.
Yeah, or rather, if it's not a... But a practical measure, so to speak.
But, of course, this will get us back to, if we make the recommendation, how is that registrant email made available? If it's remains, pardon, if it remains behind the scenes in the .com and .net world, which all, no offense to all the other registry operators, but .com and .net are the biggest kids on the block by far, then, what do we do to... you make the recommendation, how do you ensure that we don't create unintended security issues and everything else? If, you know, is there a corollary with it? Okay, only registrant can make the change, or auth info codes only provided to the registrant. Then how do the automated systems that registrars everywhere have put in place to go out, pull the information, start processing the request, how do they work? There's a disconnect there. There's more to it than just saying let's only make the registrant. We have to consider the sort of the implication of, all right, if you do that, how does the registrant contact information, how is that made available? And that's a pretty significant change in the current process.
Would it also have implications for the registrars as well? Because I'm not really certain how they govern registrant account to know for certain who has access to that account, and that it is only the registrant that would have access to that account, and how you, I guess, segregate that so that only the registrant would have access to that auth info code.
Yeah,
that's purely procedural. The registrars, from the registrar standpoint, I mean, they have pretty significant flexibility in what they want to do. So, for example, some registrars, usually more typically corporate registrars, will create security role accounts so that you could have one account owner, but then you could give, you know, various other people access to the account. And you could specify whether the person could, for example, initiate new registrations, initiate transfers, make contact changes, have access to the auth info. So it really just depends on the registrar.
Right. I expect that probably larger registrars have, I guess, more, I'll call it, infrastructure in place to be able to do that. Is it reasonable to think that some of the smaller registrars could also, without too great an expense, be able to implement a similar type structure?
I mean, again, it's just, you know, adding expense and requiring, you know, technical changes to their, you know, their registrar infrastructure. And then how do you police that? I mean, do you have ICANN's compliance team go in and look at the code that they're using to operate their registrar websites? I mean, do you have ICANN compliance set up an account and go in and audit them occasionally? I mean, I think we have to be, you know, kind of practical here and, you know, not only general, you know, create solutions that simplify the process instead of, you know, make it more difficult, but also, you know, think with an eye towards the practical perspective of, you know, how this actually work, and, you know, if it depends on every registrar implementing it, you know, how would it be enforced?
Yeah, I think Mark makes a very good point. I mean, the other side of the coin of flexibility. Flexibility is good, but it also means the flip side, that most folks are going to have to do things a little differently. And, I mean, the focus of this question is to facilitate transfers. If we're going to create a system or recommend changes that will ultimately impact multitudes of different, slightly different business models, we're not going to be simplifying. In fact, we're going to be making the process even more complex, because you can no longer set up the processes with a one-size-fits-all, which is largely what we have right now.
This is Michael Collins.
Go ahead, Michael.
I apologize for interrupting you. I really am sorry, but I'm boarding, and I may have to turn off the phone pretty quickly.
Not a problem, Michael. We're looking at the hour anyway. We only have a minute left, so.
I just wanted to say that, make sure that my suggestion was clearly different than requiring the registrar to initiate the transfer. I had stated before that I wanted to make sure that the registrant approved the transfer. This idea of requiring the registrant to be the one that initiates it is new to me. I haven't really had time to explore it, as none of us have, apparently. But I do see potential problems that in implementation. Just as a user, it looks like it would be difficult for registrars to do it. That's probably about all I can say. Sorry for the background noise again.
No problem, Michael. Thank you, and thank you for clarifying. I think I did misstate. You have consistently talked about authorization, not initiation, and that was my misinterpretation of what you said. I'm looking at the clock, folks, and we are at the top of the hour, so I think we have to draw this one to a close. I think today was an extremely productive session. Again, Barbara, if you would extend our appreciation to Scott, really was very helpful, and thank you to you, of course, for thinking to bring him onto the call.
You're welcome.
We have, next call scheduled same time next week, next Tuesday. I would just remind everybody again that we are drawing near. We only have about 10 days remain before our own constituency statements are due. So encourage everybody to be working on them, thinking about the issues, and we will pick up where we're leaving off next Tuesday. One and all, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you in a week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.